Do I need to have a journal or?
No, you're good. If you just have a seat wherever you like.
Okay.
And we're just starting with an exercise before we do introductions.
Okay.
So just choose a piece of paper from this. And there are black pens right to left and left.
Okay.
Hi, Sue. Good. And we're doing an erasure exercise. We're creating something new by way of erasing text.
So
really the goal is just to erase words that are less interesting to you and keep the words that are most interesting to you.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so just take...
So whatever
they're all
I
different,
find?
So just take whatever one speaks to you.
Okay. Let's see.
Just take one page, and there are black markers. And you're basically like, no need to think deeply about this. It's really like a like spontaneous, whatever seems to be exciting. But it doesn't have to be logical. It doesn't have to make logical sense.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm just going to put these things
off. You're leaving.
Hi, welcome.
I'm sick.
Okay, I didn't quite get the
message. Hi. Okay, great. So if you just treat this like a pack of cards, just take one.
Okay.
They're all different. And we're crossing out words. So we're going to end up with a pattern of words from what you don't cross off. Okay, so, hi, Paul, right?
Yeah,
great. Okay, so if you take one piece of paper, so from everyone who just arrived, we're doing an erasure exercise. And if you can grab either have a pen of your own, or you can grab a black pen from here. And basically the idea is we're creating something new out of this totally random text. I found it in the library. It's about nature. It has nature in it. And we're going to spend the next 3 minutes doing this, so super quick. Whatever speaks to you, leave in, and otherwise cross off words. And you can be really dramatic about it. Like, you can cross off whole sentences and, like, whole lines, because you just want to end up with a smaller set of words. That's fine. And if you have two pages, you might just choose one if you like.
Yeah.
That's totally fine. Yep. It's not a logical process. It's not about logic or making logical sense. So it's okay if it doesn't make, it doesn't add up. Thank you. Okay, great. Take about 10 more seconds just to do your last erasure line. Begin. Wonderful. Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for being here on this beautiful, sunny day and afternoon inside. And we will get outside for some of the class, so do not have no fear. I'm Kate Thorpe. I'm a PhD student at Princeton. I also have an MFA, and I came as a child to Holden. I'm really happy to be here and teaching and thinking about poetry and thinking especially about the elements this week and about the power of the elements and how to create nourishing relationships with nature by way of poetry and thinking about writing about the elements and with them, with the river, for example, on Monday. And we're focusing on fire today, so I switched it up because the exercise I want to do is a little bit longer, and so it'll be good to have a whole class focusing on fire. And it seems like a fitting day, too. I think I heard someone say that with the heat, with the sun. So I'd love to spend a couple minutes going around, because I see some new faces. I'm glad you're all here. And just doing quick introductions of if you want to just share your background in poetry. I'm so glad you're here. If you have experience in poetry, if you don't, if you have a favorite poem. And if you want to share maybe a couple of lines from what you came up with. We're going to be talking about fire and purification. Like, that's one of the words that's come to my mind as I've been thinking about fire. And we'll be ending up doing erasure again, so this exercise will come back. But I thought it might be interesting to start with a foreign text and see what comes out of erasing things that seem extraneous or even random, or like the question came up of like, how do we choose what to get rid of, right? I think that's a real question. So what appears in a kind of new way or new guise? Okay, so I just introduced myself, so I'm gonna read like two lines and then I'm gonna move around. Does that sound good? Okay. 200 varieties, Monrovia remained, picking long bougainvillea, Arby's, foothill sought compensation in the same storm. Houses. Paul, would you like to go?
Yeah, I'm Paul. I'm a church musician, and I've done some songwriting and hymn writing, and I'll read a little bit.
Great, thanks.
Undulations, immensity, smooth curves, intensest light, a bloom of plum, weltering white sea, buried in one snow shroud, dive downwards, wine traffic, precipitately sideways. We did not slip.
Mm.
I'm Laura Veed, and I'm on faculty, and I'm a political scientist based in Massachusetts. And I'm doing a workshop on lies of commitment and how to make social change. So, remarkable volcanic displays, Mackenzie Pass traverses the Central Cascades, lava fields, a forbidding desert of black jagged basalt. Several major vents contributed lava. Panorama of the several volcanoes involved. North Sister. I'm jumping ahead. Inundated. This lava is of the blocky or scoriaceous type.
Well, I'm Al Rail, and I write songs also. And other than that, I don't consider myself writing poetry. But so I just am here to be curious. So, and the piece that I got, I guess it was just kind of the wrong one. I just couldn't, you know, it either was whole sentences or, you know, so, you know, I'll read kind of what I have here. Let's see. Wet us as we had passed through a mist, so as we could neither see nor hear one another, but trusting our narrow bridges in some places made only by felling.
Nice.
That's it.
Wow. I'm Lynn, and my history in poetry is that I was read to, and I read to my grandchildren, but they're basically nursery rhymes, so. Interpretations represent a complete ecosystem of ethics. Thinking lies behind proposals. Moral considerability of individual biological organisms. It's a mouthful. Members of an ecosystem or ecosphere are diverse ways of life. Thanks.
Well, I'm Wes, and my wife Sue, we've been leading that Bible study this week and next. We've been doing Revelation, which yesterday we had the image of buying gold refined by fire, purification of fire. And this was a page from a technical geology book. And it's hot today, and my brain's a little soft, and that sounded boring to me. But what I've been working on just before I came and all summer is some American history. So I was just reading a chapter about John Quincy Adams, and when I read this thing about volcanoes in Oregon, I made a mental typo. So I'm going to read it with my mental typo, the word that it says, Mr. Jefferson's Matterhorn-like peak is an eroded plug.
I love it.
Like an eroded what?
Plug.
Plug.
Great. So, and that kind of thing happens, right? Slippage, change. Like, how does one thing become another thing? So, like, I think that's actually a really, really good question.
The difference between a lowercase t and a lowercase r when you're tired is not.
I'm Sue, obviously. Yeah, love to read poetry, use it oftentimes as entry points into the real. Don't write poetry that I show anybody else to, except occasionally something from one of my kids. So, let's see. The mountain summit was wrapped in an unusually large cloud of gray ash. Roaring and thundering of Tahoma, the mountain that was God, was more frightening than usual. Twisting valley, erupting volcano. Advancing, dropped in terror. Rushing across the prairie, overwhelmed.
Okay, I'm Dick, and poetry, contemporary poetry, is largely confined to lyrics. and folk music. Other than that, I don't quite get poetry.
Says the man who studied the Psalms for hours.
Well, Psalms is another whole thing. They're not free. Yes, it's parallel. It's a little confined. Anyhow, Mount Adams, well, I did something and then all the attempts to keep the second clause from actually happening. Mount Adams is a dormant volcano, but it is not yet dead. At times, the sulfur was strong enough, the odor of sulfur was strong enough to be detected as far as 6 miles from the mountaintop. Jet streams have not been reported. An infrared survey from an airplane could detect no evidence of abnormal temperatures. Thermal activity on this ancient volcano seems to be waning. And yet it's not dead.
I love how taking out this text, like you get all these different textures of the technical language, but also these moments of are not dead suddenly it takes on a kind of metaphysical meaning. Whereas in the technical text, right, it's like it has this.
Well, it started out with is not yet dead, and then it spends three paragraphs trying to make it dead.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying too. And you can like illuminate that. You can draw that out in a way.
Didn't work.
Do erasure. Cool. Great. Thanks.
My name is Richard. I'm a retired pastor, liturgist, musician, but still active in the liturgy and the music. I fell in love with the metaphysical poets in my early 20s, people like George Herbert, John Donne, and so on. And then I read quite a bit of poetry, and I played with free poetry, and recently, over the last couple of years, did 13 poems from Prairie Lake, which is where I grew up, west of Duluth, Minnesota, which is kind of fun. I send this off to relatives, and there's no comment at all. So. Never mind. Maybe after I'm dead, a long time it'll be famous. This is a complicated piece called "Rethinking Theology and Nature," and I just looked at the top. Oh, it's Carol Christ. And I just know of her. So I found myself crossing out everything to do with rationality in this. Mm-hmm. We are used to thinking of the mystical experience with the bird, a bodily, pre-verbal experience in relation to the earth. But we are not used to the book we read in relation to the paper it is written on, the hand that wrote it in a particular place on a particular day, and of the hand and the paper as earth, consciously shaping their experience into naming, into words. Remain within a mystical, perhaps, but relation with nature. Rename the relation with nature we experience. We are nature. We are nature seeing nature. We are nature with a concept of nature. Nature weeping, nature speaking of nature to nature. Here she is consciously using words that are not adequate to her language. I won't go on another paragraph, okay?
I'm Jack Coffey. The article is on Mount St. Helens, and the title is Fire and Ice. The crater has been represented, he said. The smoke was continually issuing from its mouth. The fire was not extinguished. The 1980 outbursts began at the northern corner of the summit dome. Although the 12th in height among the major Cascade volcanoes, St. Helens arises 6,500 feet above its base and dominates the skyline. It stands virtually alone among the loftier Cascade fellows. However, in that the forces of volcanic construction still exceed those of erosive destruction.
Great, thank you. Thank you all for sharing the super, super abrupt exercise. So thank you. I think it's so interesting how many different ways there are to approach this. So we all have started with a random text, erased some stuff, and ended up with something. And the something we ended up with was really different. Some people write, like, kept, even like basic, kept sentences intact, and some people didn't, right? I'm thinking about Paul, like a lot of like words, kind of like list and then a sentence, which was really striking at the end because we had list before and we weren't expecting that. And then some sentences where things were left out, as in yours, Richard, where like there were like gaps, or, like wait, you're like disrupting the meaning that was there, or new meanings created with new sentences, as with yours, Sue. Where like we ended up at a new thing. So many different shifting and shifting meaning and words entirely with West. So just like some example, there was just such a wide variety. It's really interesting that when we change something, there are all these different avenues and approaches of what that looks like, and there's no one right answer. There's no one right way to approach this. And there are all these different meanings that can come out of the thing, even if, even in a like, kind of counterintuitively destructive exercise, right? Like, we do this exercise, we create something by destroying something, which is why I think a lot of people, when they came in, they're like, what? Like, we're doing, like it's counterintuitive. Like, I'm allowed to take a Sharpie and just, like, cross out these sentences that are intact? And that itself is it's kind of a radical, it's also a radical revision process. And that can be transformative and wonderful and destabilize. Like, help us realize that words are solid, have meaning, create change, and are weighty. And they're also language that can flip and be shifted and be transformed and do new things and be slippery and be kind of flexible. And that's exciting too. And that the first word is not necessarily the best one always. Like, it's okay to revise then. Yeah.
I'm aware that, and I'm not saying this as if you don't know this, but it just occurred to me while you're saying this, Keith, that you're talking about this like in just a playful, creative way. Yeah. But there's also a dangerous political aspect of that, right? Erasing women's stories,
oh my gosh,
erasing
totally.
People of color stories, erasing stories that don't fit with your worldview.
Usually. Yes. That's real. Yeah.
I decided to erase the word eruption. I was like, okay, I'm just taking it up. So I absolutely was consciously like, I just started doing it.
I became obsessed with like with pronouns, like personal pronouns, and like and names.
And I erased all the references to women in relationship to nature.
Okay.
I just took them all out. Although the article I think was about nature and women.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why does that have to be just about women? I'm with nature too, you know.
Yeah, so what do you make of that?
But on the other hand, you know, I think language is temporarily consensual. If you can speak to each other, you can understand. But words evolve. Different communities use them. There's semantic range. It's unstable. So they're unstable, but at the same time, they're incredibly powerful. So that words used against someone else can... You know, just the word nigger is not a whimsical word, contextually.
Yeah.
But in China, it's nonsensical syllables. It's a sound that doesn't mean anything. So it's unstable and incredibly powerful at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just realized that I would cross out places, specific names, and then the people, the Spaniards in here. You know, I crossed out all that to make it my story. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. I just noticed that right now.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I took out negative words.
Okay. So I think that's a real question. I mean, the fire that we're going to go out in a little bit and look at some burnt trees. I mean, that fire is really dangerous. I mean, that's such an obvious thing to say, but, like, fire is dangerous. Like, I think that's a really good point. Like, what are we doing with language? Even as the willingness to be playful with language and to allow new things to unfold and to not, like, sometimes language, I think, takes us. And if we try to be too controlling, like we can miss out too on meaning that can be emerging that maybe we don't understand at first. So it's I think it's this really tough question. And then also the difference between our own work with crossing out and revising, that stage is a different one from the one where we're sharing with other people. So that's also something maybe to keep in mind, is when we're at the point of sharing and moving forward with something, then to really think and also to think through, what are all the connotations? What am I doing with this? How am I rethinking other and in conversation with other people and voices? And this is a form of conversation with these texts. Yeah, these are all great questions. So, I'd like to really quickly look at a couple of poems about fire, to have a couple of models in the air, and these are really different from each other. So one is a poem by Robert Frost from the 20s, 1923, his book called New Hampshire, Fire and Ice. Does anyone know this poem?
Did you intentionally mean something ironic there? Do you have a poem about fire by a guy named Frost?
Yeah.
That's such a sad thing.
Well, that's so funny. That's awesome. I thought the same thing. I totally didn't think about that.
Maybe
that's
Freudian.
And Jack, I think you had called yours Fire and Ice, right?
The book is called Fire and Ice.
The book is called Fire and Ice. Okay, so maybe I wonder if it's off after this poem. It might be. And then on the other side, if you flip it over, we have a poem by Susan Stewart, who's a contemporary American poet. Her book called Colin Bateman, which I have right here. And she begins the book with a long poem or section on the elements. So this is taken from that. So it's part of a longer set of poems, but I just gave you this little excerpt. So what I'd like to do, we don't have a ton of time because I really want to get outside and do our own exercise, our own writing. So what I'd like to do is actually read these together in juxtaposition and talk about how they're similar and different, and how they engage fire in similar ways and different ways. So we have some kind of models to work with before we go out. So would someone like to read the Frost poem?
Sure, I'll read.
Great, thanks.
Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Mm-hmm. I've had time to prepare it, but I just...
Brilliant. Wonderful. That was beautiful. Thank you. Would someone like to read the Susan Stewart? Or fragments. I'm not even sure if it's a full poem.
I'll read it.
Great. Thank you.
By the light of living fire, all things pulsing are drawn toward the sun and bound to be unbound from igneous earth. The salamander stirs, the phoenix wings away, and ash sustains the frailest root. Build fires to worship the wood. Burn wood to worship the fire. Read to me tonight by the fire. A book is burning in my hands.
Great, thank you. Beautiful. Okay, so how would you, first immediate responses to either of these poems and how they engage with fire? Anything surprising, evocative for you in particular?
I'm very much drawn by the first line of Susan Stewart's poem, all things pulsing are drawn toward the sun. And when I was on my hike every morning when the sun came over the ridge, I'd go like, this three times.
Sure.
Just to establish this kind of pulsing drawing, longing in me. So I really love that song.
Great.
That phrase, pulsing drawing.
Great. some associations with fire. How do we engage with and relate to fire in through language, through words? Great. All things pulsing are drawn toward the sun. Okay, how would we contrast that first line with some say the world will end in fire? How do these poets begin? Both poems about fire, how do they begin differently?
Well, Frost is thinking about destruction.
Yeah, great.
And Stewart is imagining the sun as a burning, giving giver of life.
Right.
I mean, pulsing, I imagine also being heart beating, so anything that has a heartbeat, all things pulsing are drawn toward the sun.
Great. It's about life, and that's great.
But the sun pulses.
Right.
Yeah.
In the sun itself.
Right.
Yeah. And we talked, so on Monday we talked about a poem by Denise Levertov, called River, that begins, "Dreaming the sea that lies beyond me." And we talked about the gerund of dreaming, that there's a continuity with a gerund. And that's what we get with pulsing.
But then I keep thinking the sun is going to pulse itself out of existence in 5 billion years.
Okay.
So what is all that about? You know?
Well, that's really interesting.
Will the world end in fire? Yes, the world will end in fire if it's around.
Yeah, okay, so how does Stewart, we could think about verb tenses here. Mm-hmm. Your mind goes to the future. Where does she land us? Where does she help us? How does she help us focus time-wise? If you look at, like, what kind of tenses do we have here?
It's all present.
Pretty much present.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much present. All things pulsing are drawn now. Pulsing, they're continuously now doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Bound to be unbound from igneous earth. So there, do we have, what tense is that?
Well, there's kind of a sense of both past and bound as a past tense, but then also to be unbound, so the future, so thinking both ways.
That is really interesting. Yeah, so they are bound currently, like there is a past, it's a state in the past, it's still in the present, to be unbound from igneous earth. So what do you make of that? So that's going back to Richard's point about this, like, threat or something, or something verged on the point of some kind of change. Bound to be unbound. The fact, like, what do you make of the negative there? Going back to your point, Lynn, about negatives, about taking out the negation. How is she using it there? Bound to be unbound from igneous earth.
Contradictory or...
Yeah, totally. Yeah. What does she mean by that? Like, what's the literal meaning there?
Another way to add, almost simultaneously, bound and unbound, simultaneously saint and sinner.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm stuck by the salamander. Like, it seems so out of place.
It's so interesting.
I mean, the phoenix and the ash go together.
Right?
But the salamander, this moist creature in the mud, amidst the fire and the, you know, it's just like the salamander of all things.
What about the igneous earth? Like, do you think that helps? That, like, we're grounded not just in the fire and the, we're not just unbound, we're also bound. And from the igneous earth, so there's where the salamander is? Like, does that...
I would not associate a salamander with igneous earth. Associate a salamander with, like, muddy earth or something like that. Igneous suggests rocky to me.
Yeah, right.
Lizard, maybe. A lizard stirs. Mm-hmm. But obviously she chose salamander to be, like, you know...
Well, I mean, I think igneous is kind of born from fire, so it's saying that, you know, earth does come from fire.
Right.
You know, well, walking on PCT, I'd often see these trees that were kind of debarked and violently bent and then twisted. And I look at them and I say, that's a dragon. And the salamander is a kind of dragon-like connection to me. I would have identified it like you did, but then again, this context of my thinking of those shapes as the forces.
The dragon breathes fire.
Right. That's maybe one connection that stretches.
But it's an opposite of the salamander and the mud. I'm with you.
Right.
The salamander and the mud within a fire that there's undoubtedly there's muddy ways of. I mean, it's not it's not all dry at the moment.
I don't want to take it too literally, though. The salamander is in the earth. The phoenix is a mythical bird, and the ash sustains the frailest. If I start getting into what it means, it doesn't work.
This is a really good question. How is she? So poets teach us to read their poems, right? They set up the expectations. In a world that we're free verse, where we don't have a predetermined set of rules that we're following as poets, poets teach readers their rules for their poems. So it's a question. Is she expecting us to leap to a mythical level? Is this a mythical world? Or is this a real, literal world of nature that she's expecting us to be in and understand? And so clearly there's a mythical element here with the phoenix. There's not a literal phoenix. And it's the question of like, okay, so how do, I think this is a real question. How do we read, what world are we in? Were we somewhere between the two?
Even the fact that we ask the question that way tells us what world we're in. Because people in the ancient world wouldn't have asked the question that way.
You're right.
Right.
Like as we were talking at breakfast, there are dragons in the Book of Revelation. But no one asks us, is a mythical world, right? I mean,
The world we live in empirical, like after the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment.
And if you read,
that's the world we live in with poetry.
And
it just
you read
is.
Some of the Greek, like Herodotus, or some of the Greek geographers in the ancient world, some of it by their experiences, some of it by stories they've heard, they talk about cyclopses and all kinds. And they're not imagining, they're not presenting that like a mythical world, like it's Homer's Odyssey. They're presenting it like there are strange creatures out there. And, if you went out there, you'd find all those things.
Right.
Dragons and cyclops and who knows what else,
Right. So when poets do merge the two, our empirical world of everyday life also has this phoenix, like, and also doesn't quite hold, like, it doesn't quite seem like the world we would expect.
They're in Harry Potter, that's real, right?
But it's pushing at that. I think that's one of the things this poem is doing, that it's really in this gray area of, like, a world that seems kind of real and of nature that we could touch, but also that seems like it has this mythical, mystical element.
To me, the poem goes like this, and then it goes like this.
Yeah.
It goes up and then down because it gets very concrete in the end.
Yeah. So
wood, fire, read to me, a book is burning in my hands. Mm-hmm. Well, a book isn't burning, but a book is burning in my hands. It's both end.
Yeah.
And she's gotten very incarnational all of a sudden after having gone somewhere else.
So, and then the incarnational aspect, the burning, the book is burning in my hands. Does that help? How does the rest of the poem then change how we read that?
So I feel like these first four lines are basically a description of a fire taking place.
Yeah. Okay.
So this salamander stirring is the beginning of the flames. The phoenix wings away, then the ash stains the frailest root, and then it's kind of meta. A book is burning in my hands at the end.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the italics?
Yeah,
what are the italics?
She put that in, obviously, right? I mean, the poet did the italics.
Oh, yes,
I'm
definitely.
Sure.
Of course.
Okay.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, great
just
question. Yeah, no, that's right. And the italics do go through. She uses them at the beginning of a lot of these early poems. So it's definitely a thing that she is, like, creating as a structure of her poems. Yeah.
So I have a question. The title is By the Light of Living Fire.
Yeah, so it's actually, let's see, this is page 19. It's taken from, this is one part of this really long poem called Drawn from the Generation of Fire.
Okay.
And this is like what the poem, like the first page looks like.
Drawn by what?
Drawn from the Generation of Fire.
And this is just a piece of it.
It's a piece of it, yeah. So it's basically a fragment. So having the rest of the poem might help with this. And it's the last section of this long poem.
So By the Light of Living Fire is part of the poem, it's not the title.
Yes, okay. That's right. Yeah, but it's the first, she has these different sections, and they all begin with this italicized line. So it's also, it's like not the main title, but it is like a title kind of a sort. So it stands, I really think it stands as its own thing and as part of this other thing, too. Like a sequence of poems.
So we're looking at two separate.
But the minds. Second italics are unusual of this sequence. So she's also italicizing the second line, which isn't a new section, I don't think.
Okay.
But it's doing something.
She capitalizes a
emphasis.
Second
line. Right. Yeah. Good.
Where
yeah.
she doesn't the first one.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. Mm. What is that doing in terms of emphasis? And one way to think about this too is tenses. How does the tense shift at build fires to worship the wood, burn wood to worship the fire? How is the tone different? Mm. How is the tense different?
Those are imperatives.
Imperatives. Yeah, what's an imperative for?
Commands.
It's a command.
Do it.
Do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and how does that change the tone? From description, right? We're just talking about description. All things pulsing are drawn toward the sun. And if we couldn't quite make out the description, right, it's weird. It's still just, we can make out that it's doing describing work of some kind of world, some kind of place.
It riles me up a little bit. I don't build fires to worship the wood, but I do burn wood to worship the fire. Mm. She irritated me in the first part.
Interesting. Okay.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
But what is she got kind of a, what do the Buddhists call these cones, or the contradictory,
yeah.
the statement that has contradiction built into it.
So there's like a reversal, there's contradiction,
yeah.
It's slippery, right?
Very
meaning
slippery.
Is slippery.
Like salamander.
Like salamander.
Yeah, like salamander.
I like the word salamander.
Me too.
It's off your tongue.
Yeah, I'm curious, because I reacted to, I thought at first that was the title, but the idea of living fire and the reference just to fire and fire.
Yeah.
So I was struggling with living fire and fire, because that, and so I'm curious what other people thought.
I have to tell, I've been listening to the book The Library, and it's a new fiction book, I don't know how old it is, about the Los Angeles Library Fire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating. This woman has investigated it, and she said, I wonder what it's like to burn a book. Mm-hmm. So she describes beautifully going up on a hill in Los Angeles, and of course burning anything in Los Angeles is not a good idea, and it is not here as well. So puts it on a cookie sheet, you know, a large sheet, and a day, and he has a lot of water around, and it's a paperback book, and she couldn't bring herself. It's like, what book should I burn? Because she loves books. Her husband gave her a paperback book of Fahrenheit 451.
That's an appropriate title.
So she said, that's the one I'm going to burn. And she had other copies of it. And so she puts it in this sheet, and it's like she strikes the match, and it goes out, and she strikes it again. And she catches the corner of the cover of the paperback book, and her description is just beautiful, how it she said it curls in on itself and then disappears, you know, as a roll. And then slowly, each page just keeps, and I'm doing this with my hands, but this is what I'm seeing in my mind. And dry, and then she said, and then instantly, it's gone. I'm listening to it, and she wrote it, so it's interesting to hear the description, but she wanted to know what it was like to burn a book.
Right.
And when I read that, I was like, oh,
well, it's
that
really
image just, that
we have so much to, I mean, there is so much, like historically load, this idea of burning books is so historically
yes.
loaded.
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
obviously.
Right.
This is a wonderful
yes.
book to read. Just
right.
FYI.
That's wonderful.
It's a very good book.
So here, a book is burning in my hands. It's like we can burn books, but books can also burn.
Yes.
Like, so what happens when, what does that mean when books are burning? Not we're burning books, like we're destroying them, but how can books b- burp. What does that suggest?
Her first hypothesis is living fire.
Yeah.
And the burning is a living. It is a being drawn into the book. Now my life has been booked by the story.
I mean, it goes back to Wes's comment about erasure, too. That, like, there's something destructive and deeply, like, powerful in a really, in a really scary, like disturbing way. But burning can also, there's something transformational.
Mm-hmm. That's what I think of, is transforming or igniting. Or, you know,
Igniting, burning in my hands. Right. I can't even hold it because it's so hot. So
I was thinking of refiner's fire as I was lighting up switchbacks today.
Right.
Positive images of fire.
Yeah. So, okay, so I'm just going to put that. I don't really know where to put that.
Fire gives you light. Light in the darkness.
Well, light and darkness,
It gives new growth.
Even the wood, you know, it is. You know, the wood, you're thankful for the wood when you are cold, you know, that it's there to burn it.
The comfort.
And the warmth of it, you know, that's what I get there. And then and then give thanks for the fire. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all of these seem to be very positive to me.
Mm-hmm. On that note, let's look at the Robert Frost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great question. Yeah. And then we have the phoenix, right, and Susan Stewart, too, of the transformational bird. Okay, so fire and ice. So how is this different or similar? Mm.
So what jumped out at me were a string of intertextual things, one that Frost would get, one that comes after his time, but I couldn't help but hear it. So maybe just because of what I do and the texts that are in my head, that some say the world went on fire brought into mind the post-flood story in Genesis about I will never again end the world with flood, but then I'm thinking of James Baldwin, the fire next time.
Right?
And so there, that I mean, thought that the choices aren't fire and ice, the choices were fire and flood.
Right.
But so why fire and ice?
So odd. That's so true. Yeah. That's a great question.
Yeah.
New Hampshire. Well, and he is. That's why I looked up. The poem. It's in a book called New Hampshire that begins with a poem called New Hampshire. And there are lots of
Washington.
In some ways, this is like such a crystallized poem, right? Like the short lines. We have. I'm just gonna like quickly mention these things because we don't have time to kind of like walk through them all. But like most of the lines have four beats. Yep. And then there are, and a lot of iambic pentameter, so this really continual, like this old meter, or not pentameter, iambic tetrameter, it's like four beats, old meter in English poetry, with rhyme. Some say the world will end in fire. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire, but if it had to perish twice. So this really, like, really rhythmic, very strict. Very
like hymnody in a way.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Just like that. And also a very, a rhyme scheme. So we have actual rhyme at the end of words, right? But then there are these three lines that are different. Some say in ice, period. New line. Like, that is a shock. And then at the very end, to say that for destruction ice is also great, line break, and would suffice. End of the poem. Mm-hmm. Totally shocking. All of that to say that it's an extremely compact, condensed poem, and extremely tightly knit and tightly woven. And the rhymes also do that too. They like interweave. It's not just couplets, right? We don't just have like A-A-B-B, like the same words, the same rhymes repeating. It's like a little bit, it's intertwined with each other. So we have fire rhyming with desire with fire, and then ice rhyming with twice and ice. So it's very interwoven, and suffice. So it's very interwoven and knitted together, which is really different than his other poems in this book.
Yeah.
Where, like, New Hampshire, like, he's describing these places, very cold places.
Yeah.
So same work. So that was a long segue to get to, like, why ice and New Hampshire.
It's very interesting. I just counted syllables on my fingers.
Great, yeah.
It's all eights except for those lines, three lines of four.
Yeah.
Now, that's... Yeah. I don't know what that means, but it helps the abruptness for
sure. Okay, so a poem about fire and ice. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? It's so metrical. It's so ordered and structured and controlled.
And it also contributes to my senses that the beginning, although it's obviously speculation, seems like a serious issue, the world ending, but then it ends sort of whimsically.
Yeah, and people laugh.
It's also great.
When Richard read it out loud, people laughed. Yeah. And this moment seems so heavy. So what contributes to the heaviness? Why does it seem so heavy?
Because the world ending is a heavy thing. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also, like, I'm curious about the rhetoric of it, too. Like, the world ending, how does he begin the poem, like, rhetorically speaking? Like, are there rhetorical moves he's making? Like the Levertov, dreaming the sea that lies beyond me. It's an I voice. What voice is this in? Susan Stewart, too, description. All things pulsing are drawn toward the sun. It's description. There's no I there.
Mm-hmm.
So what about this? What kind of rhetoric do we have?
Speculative.
Speculative? Yeah, some say.
First person.
Is it first person?
I think.
By the third line.
Yeah.
Yep. From what I've tasted of desire. Yep.
But starting with what others...
Yeah, it's like a rhetorical speculation.
Yeah.
Some say this, like some say that. I hold, but if it had to perish twice, so we also get this rhetorical signposting of but and an if clause. So there's rhetorical thinking and logic here.
As well as what would need to perish twice?
Yeah, right, that's so true. And illogical.
Although we did talk about the second death in Revelation.
That's right.
Well, actually, the world's gone through about two or three ice ages. It's just been a big ice cube planet several times.
Totally.
So there's been a perishing going on in the 15 billion years or so.
Great point. Well, so there's something about, like,
scientifically, I just found that out sometimes.
So there's something about, like, end that's also, like, continuous or a process? Or...
Yeah, it's been a couple of big ice ages, you know.
Yeah, like...
But what he's talking about not is about physical things. I mean, he's talking about desire versus hatred. Which one is more destructive?
Yeah. Great point.
He's immediately pulled those out of the physical.
Right.
From, like, how does he debate whether the world will end in fire or ice? How he feels about, like, what I've tasted of desire. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be kind of way too flat-footed in this thing, but... Well, he's tasted desire, so that would end in fire. You know, it's not benign. Desire and misrule will lead to fire. And hatred just freezes everything out, so that'll do. So when you speculate, you want to say, well, will the end... Debating whether it's fire or ice is evading the issue that it will end. Because in either case, it's sufficient to end it.
Yeah, and it's debating.
And what you got to confront is the ending.
Yeah, right.
The rest is just debate.
Yeah, and also
either one will suffice.
Right. Seems like either one will suffice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Both desire and hate are passions, and that they do, he seems to say, have an ending.
Not just that they will end other things, but that they have an ending. That's really interesting.
But the internal debate, to me, doesn't seem to be the core.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the start and finish chiasm or whatever you want to call it, but the business is the debate.
Yeah.
Is an evasion at the end. Either
That's
one will suffice.
Yeah. So I'm just curious about rhetoric debate and what, like, how fire is related to that. I think both of these poems are rhetorical in ways and set up. Here is how the world is. What do we do with that?
What is the world? Is the world?
What is the world?
Well, not how.
Yeah. What is the role of first, human passions?
The world will end. And then inside that is the debate about how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the issue isn't how will they end. You know, my reader responds, I don't care what frogs.
Yeah, that's fair.
In the way I
you
can't
have what,
treat
we have the
that,
bowl.
I got
yeah,
this.
Of
and so
yeah.
What I see the question of how is what's going on inside
yeah.
this bowl. But it will end. And how? Well,
right.
It'll suffice.
Right.
The
right.
how
right.
doesn't make any difference.
It'll suffice. It's such
both,
a weird word.
Both are, do we have trajectories that would lead to both.
It's such a, yeah.
So,
desire, hate.
I was going to say, is that your point, Paul? The issue is really, which is more destructive, desire or hate?
I mean, I guess I was really intrigued by what Lynn said about, you know, so I think this, it all kind of hinges on what is the world.
Is it your world? Is it a relationship?
Mm.
In a,
may not be a
that
physical.
World? I mean, is it a relationship that you're having with someone and is in that relationship and in great heat, in great angst, or will it be that you turn and walk away and go cold
yeah.
in that relationship? And we probably all have relationships.
So it could function on another plane completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not physical.
Mm-hmm. More than could, I think does.
Yeah. It's the same
but
question.
Even desire can consume the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the desire that's out of my ego, not out of the beloved's benefit.
But he takes us from a literal world to a metaphorical one, to an emotional one of the passions, mm-hmm. that it's both, like that, it's also, he's on that line between the literal and the metaphorical, of like how we move from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, as I was thinking about these poems, if that's one of the things that fire can do, that transformational force is also a force of moving. Like, that's what metaphor is. It's like starting with one thing and translating to another thing.
I know just what you're doing there, Dick, with the reader response, and we don't know what the author's intention was, and that's great. And so beyond that, I'm... get into the whole thing of that. Never mind. I'm not going to go.
Overcome.
That's back to Jack Frost. Yes. It's a road not taken.
Mm. Let's do some writing. Thank you all for these wonderful thoughts about these poems. And I just want to say this is really, like, I love that we've delved into complex territory that doesn't have one right answer. And that's one of the things I really love about poems, is the ambiguity. And I think these poems especially do that. Yeah, because of the different levels and layers that we're working with. So just make sure you have paper and there are pencils going around, and we're going to take a little walk. So we're going to take a little walk. We're going to walk up to the chalets and then walk to the right. So I don't know if you've been to the 10 mile like falls hike. We're not going to walk the hike, obviously, we don't have time. But we're going to go a couple of steps on that trail. And you can see burnt trees. And so what I want to do is spend a couple of minutes attending to the burnt trees and the live trees. It's this really amazing place where we see both. There are some trees that aren't burnt at all, and then there are some that really have been. And so what I'd love to do is to spend a few minutes, describing, if you could just find a tree that is calling to you, a burnt tree and a live tree, and spend a few minutes describing each.
We'll
be coming back here. Oh, I hope we have time. Sorry, we just were
running.
Dinner's
only till six.
Till six, yeah. So this is supposed to go till 5:30. So okay. let's march up and try to spend 5 minutes describing each. And this is, think about this also as like a propelling into another, like if you need more time later, you could come back and continue this.
It can be prose poetry.
Prose poetry, anything. And we're going to come back and then we're going to do a further work with these descriptions. So try to pay attention to what you see, what do you smell, what do you touch of these two kinds of trees. Okay, does this seem clear? I'm really sorry, this time management thing, I should have said it. My discussion was just so rich. So hard. Oh my gosh.
I think you apologize.
That's right, I have my alarm.
I promised myself.
There's no fire tonight.
No fire?
No.
come back way ahead of her.
I hope, I really want, that's part of my goal for this class, is to bring poetry to a wider culture. And like, and not just in terms of the metaphor, like the surface reading, but like, how does it form? How does this help to create? There are all these tools that are really helpful tools that we can all use in writing. And it's a really powerful way of thinking and using language. And then relating to we have 5 minutes. We need to come back. Okay, please, everyone. Oh, that's... So, everyone, please, come back. Okay, so we have 5 minutes. So, what I'd like to do is another erasure exercise with your text that you have. And you can do this in one of two ways. One is the semi-destructive way. You can cross out words and create something new. Create a new text or say poem.
Of what we've written.
Out of what you've written. One way is to cross out. That's right. One way is to cross out. The other option is to find common words between the two different texts you've written. Circle those words in common. And you can use those as the basis for a poem. So it's either through connections or it's through erasure. And either way, you'll end up with something that's shorter, that's a kind of refined, shall we say, or crystallized, or other version, another transformed version of what you have. And there's no right answer.
Well, then go.
You can use a pencil.
I need an editor for
share these now since we...
Yes, oh, we just have a couple minutes. Thank you. How is everyone doing?
Here just because they know we're...
Yes. with dinner. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, do you want to pause and we can share for a minute? And you can always come back and finish later on. Yeah. Would you like to start?
Sure. Thanks. So I have two very brief ones. Bright black bark, shining sunnily at tree foot, now dead. That's one. And then, slightly scorched this tree, the inferno upon her neighbors escaped. Next.
And feel free if you want to share, like whatever you want to share is totally good. There's no pressure at all.
Yeah. Black, broken, decaying, and giving back. My purpose, nourishment. Reaching tall, seeking light. Carrying nourishment. My purpose, shade and shelter.
Great. I love the eye voice.
Okay. Branches still green, you stand with slight bend. Somehow, you stood while firestorm shot upward. You still offer shade, places for nests. I'd say, you'd say, my hot blast. One, little tree, no life, just fragments of sticks protruding from your unfortunate trunk. One day you'll fall and turn into soil. That's the way the fire replenishes the ground.
Thank you.
The texture of bark, sap descending, hard and sticky, solid, a shift. How is this alive? Anchored and growing amongst falling limbs, spreading outward, up and down. And then there are two, seven. Survivor of heat, standing still yet, weakened, black mat, crying, dried sap, still a river, broken and resilient.
Lovely. Thank you. I love the question in there.
Sure. Lengthwise, crackled, dusted, carved, resting, charred, hiding. Cathedral, sprouting, throwing, flexing, dancing, remembering, a home.
Also black and burned. How do I know the log aches? The bone, the tree is surprisingly long. A stump is, and one tree is burned just on the bottom part. It is narrow, and there is a line of black, maybe unburned.
I ended up writing words and then two separate poems and then try to connect something that turned into this, which I still don't like, but I'll read it. White pitch running down black trunk, capricious fire leaving bruised, dead, ugly. Yet some fir trees remain bowed in green beauty, needles dancing in breeze, still bent by avalanche, offering balm, forest floor regenerating.
Okay. Grass green, stumps black. Life, death, death, life, nature's cycle. Life, death, my chronology. Shall the stump yield green? Such is the promise given. Mm-hmm.
And as usual, I just got to a place where I listed a bunch of words, and what I noticed was the things, the words or the phrases, that were the same or parallel in the charred and in the living.
I was curious if that would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was kind of just holding that and seeing that and being with that, so I haven't put them together yet, but kind of, the life and death, you know, chosen mysteriously, saved when closer to home, and life lost and fading, So I was just kind of with the, what struck me in both the living and moving toward death and dying of both being regenerative.
Yeah, love that. I'd be curious about mirror, mirror poems, or if these things are woven together.
Yeah,
I'm curious about if you keep working with these two parts, if there's like how they'll be in relationship to each other. Wonderful. Well, so we have like negative 2 minutes. But does anyone have any quick responses to this exercise? Was this like interesting?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a good exercise because of the contrast and you've got to work with some opposites.
Yeah.
So out of the opposites can come something
what
new.
What happens? Right. Yeah, what happens from that?
And you're just, both today and the other day, you're just getting to slow down. And, just be present to small things rather than the big picture. It's easy to see the big picture.
Right. I became obsessed with the patterns on the bark. And how the pattern is so different when it's living versus dead. Like, I felt the same way from my own experience. Good. Okay.
Yeah, I love the paying attention to detail and moving deeply into, very small moments,
because that's what poetry can do.
Yeah, right. Draw you in.
You set the stage nicely with the two poems that you chose.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your generous contributions. And
you want our poems?
It's really, these are totally yours.
Are you teaching anymore the rest of the week?
Yeah, on Friday. So come back on Friday, for we'll be talking about air and earth.